Hello, everyone. Today we're going to be talking about an underrated thinker, partly because he does not fit cleanly into any of the main intellectual traditions or political sides that people think of. That thinker is Georges Sorel, who wrote a fantastic book on the myth of violence and its various uses. And let us get on with his core ideas here. His first big idea is that myth is a central driving force, inspiring people to act with conviction and sacrifice. If you want to make sense of history, argues Sorel, you need to understand the power of myth. You need to understand that people aren't motivated by abstract ideals or by reason or by coherent arguments. They tend to be driven by these myths. They furnish movements with emotional power, unity of purpose, and the will to struggle. It is the irreplaceable engine of political action. One of the examples that Sorel gives of a powerful myth in Reflections on Violence, which is the aforementioned book I talked about, is the total revolutionary general strike as a literal operational plan and as a galvanizing image. So he had in mind, of course, the general strike that led to, you know, the idea of a workers' revolution. And it's worth understanding that Sorel is a revolutionary thinker. Many of the people I've looked at have implicitly or otherwise supported the status quo or supported the maintenance of order. Sorel was an explicitly revolutionary thinker who wanted to break up the existing order and replace it with a new one. And he saw great potential in the general strike as a galvanizing image, a myth that sustains class solidarity, that renews fighting spirit, that orientates the proletariat towards rupture rather than compromise. Now, what's important to understand here is that the actual correctness of the cause of the strike is neither here nor there. The actual arguments used to justify this strike or that strike, or, you know, whether it's over, you know, wage rates, or, you know, whether wages are tacked to the price of coal, all of this stuff doesn't really matter. What matters is the image, the overall aesthetic and emotional effect of the worker seeing himself as part of a heroic struggle against power for the justice of his own cause. This is the myth of the general strike. And he's using it, I should mention, as an example of a modern myth that has some power to move people, or did have at some point. There was a big general strike, I think, in the 1920s in this country, and in the 1930s as well. Anyway, the critique of rationalism and parliamentary socialism. So Sorel argued that gradualist parliamentary socialism of the Menshevik stripe, you know, the whites as opposed to the reds, was fundamentally flawed. It was out of touch. You know, this is the politics of not only the Mensheviks, but of the Fabians, the Fabian Society, and various other gradualists. And of course, this thinking would apply to the right as well as to the left. It is the difference between people who believe that you can get change in the direction you want through the mechanism of parliament versus those who fundamentally believe that is a pipe dream. He says that the real dynamics of power, corrupted by compromise and incapable of genuine transformation. So, if you take the step on the path of reform, and by that I both don't and do mean Reform UK. Okay, so reform, namely being we're going to change the system by essentially becoming part of the system. For Sorrell, this is going to lead to all of the things that the elite theorists then talk about, the iron law of oligarchy and so on and so forth. He says that the intellectual, the rationalist intellectual, mistake abstract schemes for political reality. So intellectuals, time immemorial, have sat down and tried to plan, tried to come up with, you know, schemas for what they stand for, a set of bullet points, or, you know, articles of dogma, whatever. Their faith in incremental progress weakens the working class and fails to liberate it. So Sorrell had very little time for intellectuals. We'll come back to this in a moment. Parliament basically is a containment engine. It is expert in co-option, in co-opting, right? As I've said so many times, your anger, their agenda, your anger, their agenda, on feasting upon popular discontents in order to neutralize the actual power of dissent. This is the nature of containment. It will start using the talking points of, let's say, revolutionary workers' leaders, okay? But then it will transform their class struggle into a managed competition between elites. Now your union leader becomes yet just another politician. Now your workers' party become just another group among the competing groups of parliamentary democracy. And so what you wanted is muted. The energy that you had built up is contained and actually feeds back into strengthening the system. Sorrell saw all of this, and because he was revolutionary, as opposed to reformist, he opposed it and encouraged revolutionary parties and leaders to go in the opposite direction. He argued, did Sorrell, that violence is both creative and regenerative, specifically proletarian violence. That is violence from the organized workers. Sorrell, it would not be accurate to say that he was a Marxist. He had his own form of kind of syndicalist socialism. It's called Sorrellianism or Sorrellism. You can look it up. And in order to justify why he thought the workers taking matters into their own hands and actually becoming violent was justified, he basically makes a distinction between what he called bourgeois force, which is always and everywhere repressive state violence that works in the service of maintaining privilege, and proletarian violence, which is direct offensive action by workers. The latter is a purifying and heroic force, according to Sorrell, because it breaks the moral decay of bourgeois society. It resists the corruption of reformism, and it restores sacrifice and moral seriousness to the proletariat. So he actually thought that there was an inner heroic, like there's a myth, if you want, to violence. Just as there's the myth of the general strike, there's a myth of violence. And he isn't meaning myth in a negative sense. He's talking about its heroic potential, its inner potential to create genuine strikes against power. Now, this idea has all sorts of later purchase in various different revolutionary thinkers. On top of my mind, the early work of the Marxist Antonio Negri in the 1970s somewhat went in this direction. It was given a popular depiction, I would argue, in the film Fight Club, when in Fight Club they take to acts of actual vandalism and violence against the faceless corporations and chain stores and so on and so forth. So And the idea is that this cuts through all of the politeness. It cuts through any bullshit, basically. It cuts through all of the bourgeois defense layers, okay? Now, in today's parlance, in the parlance of social media, a lot of people would say, well, George Sorrell, you're basically fed posting on Maine, they'd call it. They're fed posting, right? Sorrell was fed posting on Maine. And there is some truth to that. There is some truth to the fact that he was basically advocating violence. Okay. Obviously, this channel does not advocate violence, but George Sorrell did. And so what sort of arguments would he make against those people who would caution against that, myself included? Well, you'd say, well, the trouble is that ultimately all of you people warding against this are acting in the interest of the bourgeois. You're basically reinforcing the bourgeois norm, which works in the service of maintaining privilege. Basically, you're acting as a bourgeois yourself by arguing that the maintenance of law and order above all else is the most important thing. Actually, if you're truly a revolutionary, you want to bust all that down. And, you know, viewed neutrally in a value-free way, you could have a look at all of the political movements in history that did actually take Sorrell's advice. Did they get more of what they want, or did they get less of what they want? Now, I would argue that any honest assessment of that, looking at the history of Britain, for example, would say that, broadly speaking, whenever the proletariat took to the streets, they did actually succeed in making the system shift. Okay, whether it was through the mechanism of the general strike or through various other riots that we've seen through history, there is a certain efficacy. Now, this should not be mistaken for a revolutionary victory, and it should not be mistaken for saying that the peasant revolt wins over the organized minority of power. Okay, that is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, when the workers do get violent in the manner that Sorrell is suggesting, it forces the system to shift. Now, individual people will end up on the wrong side of the law. Individual people will end up going to jail and things like that. Okay, the repressive bourgeois apparatus will kick into gear. Okay, all of that stuff will happen. But also, the fact of violence, then, if you remember your Pareto, makes the Fox style elite a little bit jittery. And so it forces them to kind of start making concessions and things like that. You can see other examples of this on the left. In America, the civil rights movement was not all peace and love. It was not simply pretty speeches by Martin Luther King. It was violent. Lots of the gains of the civil rights movement in the 60s were gained by violence, through violence. In some cases, literally putting streets on fire. And we saw a repeat, an echo of that in the so-called Summer of Love in 2020, when the Black Lives Matter movement, BLM, was incredibly violent. And despite that violence, still ended up remarkably getting their own way in all sorts of, businesses and the establishment basically bending over backwards, as opposed to other groups that you might think of that played by the rules and did not have the system bending over backwards for them. Now, there's all sorts of arguments that can be made about this. I tend to be skeptical about going this route, and I've been on record saying that many, many times, partly because the powers that be are wise to this in a way that they may not have been in Sorrell's time. The difference between now and when Sorrell was writing is a robust secret security state and the intelligence services. That is the rise of the CIA and the FBI in America, the rise of MI5 and MI6 in this country, which basically thrive on infiltrating dissident groups and then making them, quote unquote, Fed post, and making them say things that seem like they're advocating for violence. And then that's how they quash the movement, or they use that as a pretext to strike down. So you could argue that the political technology around these things has advanced. And I'd be interested to see, you know, if Sorrell could come back, what he would have to come back on that. I would say that in the late 19th century, there was a certain power and truth to what he was saying, even in the early 20th century. But given those events, power, capital P power, learnt from them. It learnt from them and made it massively, massively more difficult to use these tools. Then you could say, well, okay, well, what about the example of BLM that you just mentioned? And my explanation for BLM was not actually independent dissident groups organizing for themselves. I think BLM was a counter-revolutionary force, tacitly state-backed, you know, what you could call a counter-gang, okay? So, yeah, I actually, you know, in these videos I've been presenting the ideas, but this is one where I think circumstances, technology, and events have somewhat overtaken what Sorrell was saying. So even when the heat rises, okay, even when things look like they start getting kinetic, the modern state has tools at its disposal that the early 20th century and late 19th century states did not, which makes things massively more difficult, because concessions that would have been gained through these sorts of means in the past no longer need to be granted, because the technology puts the intelligence security state at such an advantage. Okay. Speaking of a rising heat, do you know what? It's summer, and that means promo code Scorcher. When we come back, we'll get more in detail on Sorrell. Pick up a course, ladies and gentlemen. Pick up a course. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. 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 Promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now. So while that was playing, I was thinking about what Sorrell might say to some of my objections. And one of the things that he might say, if he could come back now, if the theoretical time-traveling Sorrell came to 2026, he'd say, well, the thing is, guys, you didn't listen to me, did you? You didn't. The revolution did not take place. And now maybe it's too late. The bourgeois won. Maybe Sorrell would say that the bourgeois won out, and now they've made it very difficult for the proletariat, who now have, truly do have the boot on their necks. Your lack of taking heroic action when it mattered, your inability to see through the tricks of the bourgeois, their containment games, their parliamentary co-optings, you know, playing by their rules. That's why you failed, Sorrell would say. Now it may well be too late. Now, I don't know if he would say that, but I suspect that he would be thinking along these sorts of lines. So as I said, there are two kinds of violence, according to Sorrell. The bad kind of violence, which is bourgeois violence, and the good kind of violence, which is the proletariat violence. Sorrell insists on this distinction being moral. It's not merely tactical. It's not like, you know, sometimes it's a good idea and sometimes it's not. It is literally, if you're doing violence in the name of the bourgeois, you're on team evil, basically. And if you're on, if you're doing proletarian violence in the name of revolutionary struggle, armed struggle, you're doing good. Animated by the myth of the general strike, okay, proletarian violence functions as a form of moral education, a creative act capable of clearing the ground for a new civilization. And make no mistake, Sorel truly did want to clear them out, replace them with a new order. He was, and this is why he's difficult to place on left or right, is because he takes elements of both leftist thought, clearly his workers' struggle, his workers' revolution, but he also takes some ideas from the right as well, in what might broadly be called syndicalism. So, yeah. Also for this reason, George Sorel has attracted fans from the left, like Negri and various other people who I've mentioned, who take inspiration from his uncompromising and somewhat hardcore nature, but also he's attracted fans from the right for the same reason. Again, obviously on the more radical or revolutionary end. Sorel argued that parliamentary democracy fundamentally is a fraud. Why? Because it masks real power. Democratic institutions conceal the underlying class antagonisms and present managed compromise as legitimate representation. Think about the process, right? You're that miner, for example, who's gone on the general strike. Okay, I've had enough of this. Down with the bastards. Okay? We're doing all the work here. We're the ones being screwed. Down with all this. We want to take over. And then some politician stands up there and says, maybe I'll do my best Tony Blair impression. Hello, we've heard you. I understand your concerns. We hear you. And, this is what I have to say to the British worker. I have to say this. We understand that things have been difficult, but we will be a government that truly represents you. Here are the changes we're going to make Britain a freer and a fairer country for everybody. We truly will represent the British worker. Okay. Now, maybe Tony Blair was the wrong person to choose. Maybe I should have chosen Andy Burnham or somebody like that. But this is basically the mechanism that Sorel is talking about, because if you're a true blue revolutionary, okay, if you're a true blue revolutionary rather than somebody who is representing the interests of the bourgeois, if you're a true blue revolutionary, you say, what? You can't represent me. You're one of them. You're working for the system. You're working with you're one of them. You'll just screw me over again. I don't want some compromise. I want to take your place. But let's pretend that you're not that true blue revolutionary, that you're just an easily tricked worker. So, I kind of like the idea that this Tony, he's speaking a lot of sense, that Andy Burnham. Speaks a lot of sense. Tell you what, I'll get behind him. I'll vote for him, and maybe all my wishes will come true. Fell for it again, huh? So, this is basically what Sorel is getting at, because the idea that politician can legitimately represent you and your interests is a pipe dream. The bourgeois are never going to represent the workers fairly, according to Sorel. They will always represent their own interests. They will always maintain their own power. They are not going to share it. It must be taken from them, says Sorel. Next reason that parliamentary democracy is a fraud: it breeds corruption. Electoral competition incentivizes opportunism. Working class leaders are co-opted, their energies redirected from struggle into parliamentary careerism. I was the first Kinnock in 1,000 generations to go to university, to get an education that was denied. What happened to Neil Kinnock? Did he, as a true blue representative of the British workers, dedicate his life to overthrowing the bourgeois? Or did Neil Kinnock become a ribald careerist whose son then became part of the ruling architecture, Stephen Kinnock? Stephen Kinnock then becomes almost like a kind of minor noble and minor bourgeois aristocrat in this system who lives to service his own bourgeois career. Okay, I don't know why I'm picking on the Kinnocks. They were just the first ones to come to my mind. But this is what he's talking about in action. How can the son of a genuine proletariat worker like Neil Kinnock end up becoming the feckless, middle-class, bourgeois, careerist, establishment man, shill for the status quo that he became? Sorrell would say it is because parliamentary democracy itself is a fraud. It is there to trick you out of your own interests in the service of their interests. And in his lens, it's the bourgeois. It's their system. They're not going to... They will parcel out bits of it to allow you to become one of them. But they are not going to hand over the keys or share it properly with the workers, says Sorrell. Okay? Now, if this sounds a bit much for a lot of people, it's because that's the difference between a firebrand revolutionary and someone who, you know, would rather not see that kind of level of disruption. But if you're one of those people who would rather not see that level of disruption, Sorrell would argue you are in fact de facto a bourgeois and serving bourgeois interests. Now you might object, you'd say, well, hold on a second, AA, that's not quite fair. I'm a card-carrying socialist and I've always voted Labour, blah, blah, blah. You'd say, no, rubbish. Labour are a bourgeois party. You are a bourgeois, you just won't admit it. You're not honest with yourself. You don't actually embody the ideals that you say you want to fight for. You have been co-opted. You have been tricked. And, you know, I'm often reminded of the punk, you know, the punk rocker, the modern day, I'm a punk. I'm going to spend all my time evangelizing for DEI, you know, anti-racism, and you know, fighting Nazis, let's say, okay, the exact ideology of the state, the exact ideology of the bourgeois state itself, the exact politics of Tesco's and Sainsbury's and Goldman Sachs and every other major corporation that you can think of, right? And the irony of this has not been lost on people. Rage for the machine, rage for the machine. But those people tell themselves that they're being rebellious in some way, that they're being punk. So I would say you're a phony, is what he'd say. And of course, parliamentary democracy kills class struggle. The logic of parliament demands coalition and concession. It systematically dissolves the combative solidarity that Sorrell saw as the proletariat's defining virtue. Okay, the working man finds strength in solidarity, organized action like the general strike, and yes, violence, according to Sorrell. If you accept the demands of getting involved in parliamentary politics, all of those tools are taken away from you. And therefore, you know, you're neutered. Interesting. Sorrell held that human beings are moved far more by myth, by instinct, and by emotion than by rational calculation. And this is going to be the theme of much of this week. All of the thinkers I'm looking at this week are really interested in this idea that people aren't motivated by reason, they're motivated by emotion and instinct. Effective political action must speak to these deeper forces. It must speak to the heroic, to the sacrificial, and to the collective, rather than appealing to self-interest or abstract principles. And this is really what Sorrell had in mind. I'll move myself out of the way here, which is, so his particular brand of socialism is syndicalism, which puts power directly in the hands of the workers. Okay. Sorrell championed syndicalism, that is organization and direct action by workers' own syndicates. He said this was superior both to reformist socialism, that is, you know, something like the Labour Party, okay, or the Fabian Society, and it was superior to state socialism of the kind that we saw in Soviet Russia. It keeps power with the workers. It avoids the corrupting influence of parties, and it preserves the combative energy essential to genuine emancipation. It is decentralized, it is worker-led and organization. It strikes as a primary instrument of struggle. Okay, so that is using general strikes as a struggle, because, you know, if the workers are organized, they can always strike. And of course, the refusal of integration into state structures. And there you can see where these intersections are. Syndicalism is direct, it is worker-led, it is combative, it is morally vital. State socialism has the weakness of being centralized and bureaucratically party-controlled. Well, if the party are controlling it, the average worker could get screwed out of that situation, as did happen many times. And of course, in the reformist socialism, it's all the stuff about the parliamentary fraud that we talk about. It's fundamentally compromised. It's fundamentally top down. So Sorrell's answer was syndicalism. Now, can syndicalism actually work? Okay, is there? I would argue that there are some problems, basic organizational problems with getting this idea up and running. One of them is to do with hierarchy and decision making. The elite theorists would say, well, you know, if we go back to Robert Michels, who was writing after Sorrell, let's not forget. But if we go back to Michels, he would say, well, look, this syndicalism problem, you're still going to need a leader. You're still going to need an inner circle. You're still going to need an organized minority within the syndicalist collective. And so then therefore power will accrue to those people. You're not going to actually solve the problem simply by having these like syndicalist groups. So it doesn't really solve the iron law of oligarchy in that way. Sorrell might fire back and say, well, yeah, so what? Those leaders are going to be closer to actually representing the workers, you know, apart, let's say, you know, they're a factory, they're a collective who own a factory together, and there's an appointed board of that factory. Those board members who are all workers themselves are going to be a lot closer to them than the either the commissar from the centrally led Politburo, right, or from the you know, the parliamentary party in Westminster or in Washington or wherever else. Who's basically, you know, sold out to the regime. So, you know, that's how Sorrell, would it work? I don't know. I mean, there is such a thing as workers' cooperatives, some of which have been fairly successful, The most famous one in this country is actually the Co-op, which is a supermarket which I believe is still worker owned and operated and led. Is it any different from any normal supermarket from the outside? No. Does it? Has it successfully withstood all of the managerial mantras of the time? No, not at all, I would argue. So, you know, if we take the Co-op as an example, well, the Co-op, you know, the Co-op is probably as woke as your favorite punk band, right? The Co-op is probably espousing the same stuff as the Labour politician. So it hasn't worked as a kind of bulwark against the rest of society in the way that Sorrell envisaged. Whether that's a fair one, maybe a Sorrellian, right, may be able to put a more robust example than the Co-op. Sorrell argued against optimistic progress, like many of the thinkers I've covered in this series. He rejected Enlightenment narratives of inevitable improvement. He says bourgeois society was decadent and is decadent. It can only be renewed through struggle and heroism. European civilization can only be revitalized through a worker struggle, according to Sorrell. A worker struggle that captures heroic myths and heroic action. You can't embody that if you keep on compromising yourself by engaging in parliamentary politics, Sorrell would say. He also attacks the intellectual, as we've touched on. He said abstract theorists weaken the fighting spirit of the workers. Sorrell preferred the practical wisdom of those engaged in direct action over the armchair schemes of reformist socialists. And if all of this successfully took place, we would find a new moral order. His ultimate vision was a proletariat movement animated by powerful myths, willing to use direct action, okay, capable of forging a new ethic of heroism, of solidarity, and of productive labor, replacing bourgeois decadence with a more vital, creative civilization. Myth galvanizes collective will, sustains combative identity. Violence purifies, educates, and clears the ground for renewal. And direct action enacts the struggle and builds the new moral community. Now, of all the thinkers that I've touched on in this series, I probably have the most issues directly with Sorrell. I've got some disagreements with him. I've touched on some of those already. Partly, he couldn't have foreseen the rise of the security state, things like MI5 and MI6 or the CIA and the FBI, and how advanced the techniques of surveillance, infiltration of different dissident groups and things like that would become in the late 20th century and the early 21st century. So he couldn't have foreseen all of that. But I suspect that Sorrell, you know, if he didn't chastise the workers for not having embraced their destiny and overthrown the bourgeois by now, he'd say, yeah, but the trouble with UAA is that you are one of those intellectuals that I'm talking about, aren't you? Ultimately, UAA are an apologist for the bourgeois order who preaches non-action, who preaches against violence, who preaches... You basically want to sit on your hands, he would argue. my argument is, well, it's all well and good to say that direct action, you know, leads to the promised land, as he does. But what about all those people who will not, like, what happens if your struggle just gets crushed? Which is the fate of most people taking this sort of action in history, just gets crushed. And not only does it get crushed, the crushing of the dissent then strengthens Leviathan, Where's my Robert Higgs book, Leviathan and His Enemies, which I quote so often? Leviathan uses the crisis to strengthen itself, okay, thereby putting the heroic action that Sorrel is talking about out of reach for another generation or so, because while they're in power, they will use the myth, they will actually use a kind of counter myth to quell whatever that thing is, crush that thing utterly, and reinforce their own power. So, yeah, this is where I guess there is some difference between myself and Sorrel. It may make for an interesting stream. If people have really, like, if people have interesting questions or counters to anything I've said here or in general, maybe I'll pick them up on a future stream, because Sorrel is a figure of interest, but he's somebody who I have some issues with. All right, pick up a course at the Academic Agency. It's promo code SCORCHER, and I'll see you all next time.